the 7 people on board and departed the vessel and safely managed to get onto the oil platform.
An oil supply boat sinks in Cook Inlet. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 15th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Coast Guard honors the crew that rushed to aid the Alaska Ranger last spring.
It's a pretty big award for something that anybody else would have done in the same situation. We just did our best.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just Pick, Click, Give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
An oil industry supply boat sank near an offshore platform in icy Cook Inlet today after it began taking on water in the early morning hours. The 166-foot Monarch was delivering supplies to the Granite Point platform on the west side of the inlet north of Nikiski when ice pinned it against the platform and the vessel began to flood. Coast Guard Public Affairs Officer Sarah Francis says the captain and crew were able to evacuate the Monarch onto the oil platform. Because the boat sank beneath the platform, the crew and 7 non-essential platform workers were then flown via helicopter to shore. Francis says only one minor injury was reported.
The chief engineer of the Monarch was treated and released for contact with diesel fuel and exhaust inhalation.
The Monarch has between 35,000 and 38,000 gallons of diesel fuel on board. Francis says the vessel was also transporting 6 stainless steel totes, 3 plastic drums, and 8 steel drums containing various amounts of oil and chemicals. The chemicals are considered hazardous but not overly toxic, and Francis asks that anyone who finds a drum or tote notify the Coast Guard immediately. A light sheen has been noticed in the area, but Francis says it's not a major concern.
According to NOAA, 38,000 gallons of diesel would disperse and evaporate from Cook Inlet waters within 12 hours, the duration of one tidal cycle.
The tug Vigilant is currently on scene, and the Coast Guard cutter Hickory is en route. The cleanup contractor Alaska Shadow Corporation is also responding. Francis says a unified command has been established in Nikiski, consisting of representatives from the Coast Guard, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, the oil and shipping industries, and the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council. Right now, they're turning their attention to salvaging the Monarch, which could take several days.
We have a number of assets coming, but right now we need to develop the salvage plan, and that's going to depend a lot on the condition of the vessel and the circumstances of it. They anticipate using divers and locating a side scan sonar so that they can make some assessments of the vessel, figure out what the best way to raise and move it is.
The Granite Point platform is operated by Chevron and located in North Cook Inlet, about 45 miles south of Anchorage. The Monarch is operated by Offshore Systems Incorporated of Kenai. The company is not talking to the media at this time. The crew members of the Alaska Warrior were honored today by the City of Unalaska and the U.S. Coast Guard for their essential role in rescuing 42 people off the Alaska Ranger when it sank last spring. KUCB's Ann Hillman attended the ceremony.
Unalaska Mayor Shirley Marquardt presented an award from the Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard to the captain and the crew of the Alaska Warrior, the Alaska Ranger sister ship.
Generally, our services are a lot more somber and sad. But this one, this ceremony, is, even though there's tragedy and there's sorrow involved in it, there's got to be a great deal of joy and exhilaration in what you all did when you went to the aid of your sister ship.
Captain Scott Cray accepted the award on behalf of his crew.
It's a pretty big award for something that anybody else would have done in the same situation. We just did our best.
Cray and his crew helped the Coast Guard search for the men of the Alaska Ranger for more than 4 hours in 8-foot seas. Cray describes the events of Easter morning, 2008.
Well, we left Dutch Harbor 6 hours after the Ranger. We were basically going to the same place as them. About 2:30 in the morning, we got a distress call. Said they were taking on water. When we arrived at the scene about 6:30 in the morning, I had a faint blip on the radar of the Ranger, and then all of a sudden it was gone. Rescue lights everywhere, helicopters, people in the water, and we just started picking people up, life rafts, and the dead also, three friends of ours.
His crew quickly learned the best way to get the men onto the life rafts and transport them to the Warrior. On board, other crew members and the fisheries observers were working to make sure people were comfortable and taken care of.
My guys worked hard. After that happened, I lost a lot of crew members. I lost like 16 crew after that because they were pretty shaken up.
Some of those crew slots were filled by surviving crew members of the Alaska Ranger. Isaac Mumbaya said he thought the best way to honor the crew of the Alaska Warrior was to join them.
And first and foremost, I'd like to thank the Warrior for saving our lives. I'd like to say appreciate it to everybody.
The Alaska Ranger sank on March 23, 2008. 5 of the 47 crew members were lost. An investigation of the sinking is still underway. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Officials from the Alaska Peninsula community of King Cove are pleased with today's Senate passage of a huge lands bill that includes language authorizing the Interior Secretary to determine whether a land exchange in the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge is a good idea. The legislation also requires an environmental impact statement that would examine how an emergency road from King Cove to Cold Bay may impact the refuge. King Cove Mayor Ernest Weiss says currently King Cove residents can only access the airport at Cold Bay by using a hovercraft.
They have been taking medevacs, but as far as if the winds are over 35 miles an hour or if it's below 25 degrees, they will not take it in a normal situation. And so, yeah, it's not that reliable. And plus, it's costing the Aleutians East Borough, who owns it, an awful lot of money to subsidize it.
King Cove residents have lobbied for the road for two decades, saying it's needed for reliable access to the airport. But environmental organizations have fought the idea, saying the road would cut through the heart of the Eisenbeck and could negatively impact waterfowl migration patterns. The swap would exchange 61,000 acres of State and King Cove Corporation land for 260 acres of the Eisenbeck Refuge for a single-lane road. Stan Center with Audubon Alaska says merely swapping land in unrelated areas isn't a fair exchange. Center also says amending the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, ignores already established language that deals with questions of transportation across lands set aside by the Lands Act.
This legislation bypasses that process without even ever having tried the process. So it's a bad precedent all the way around, and I think in the long run it will prove to be a mistake.
An actual road from King Cove to Cold Bay still has a long way to go before it may become reality. The legislation still has to pass the House and be approved by the President. And even if that happens, the law only authorizes the Interior Secretary to decide if the exchange is in the public's interest and sets the lengthy EIS process in motion. If those steps pass muster, funding would be needed by the state and King Cove community to build a road. It's not clear when the House may take up the legislation. Robert Dillon is the communications director for the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Dillon works with Senator Murkowski, who has pushed for the King Cove project. He says the lands bill also contains other components for Alaska, including language granting competitive status for some National Park Service employees.
This goes to people who've been doing the job for maybe years, but maybe not, you know, have the master's degree or the college education that would qualify them to meet the standards of the requirements of the service. But they're actually doing the job anyway, so it helps get more local people hired.
The public lands legislation also includes a proposed amendment to the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act to allow the federal coordinator the authority to establish fees for processing work and use the money collected to help speed the pipeline process along without asking Congress for funds. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a dramatic decline in fur seal pup numbers on the Pribilofs.
It's a concern because St. Paul continues to be the largest producer of fur seal pups in the world, so it's a significant part of the worldwide population.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP. giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home.
Working late? Hear Alaska News nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
A new lawsuit has been filed against the Oregon Society of Jesus, alleging sexual abuse by clergy it provided to Alaska Catholic parishes. The suit was filed Tuesday in Bethel by 43 men and women who say they suffered the abuse in Western Alaska villages. The claims span four decades up until 2001. The Jesuits share responsibility for the priests with the Fairbanks Diocese, which filed for bankruptcy under a hail of abuse suits last year. Plaintiff's attorney Chris Cook says the additional claims arose out of the diocese Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Through the bankruptcy process, there was publicity asking people who had claims against the bishop to come forward, and many more people did come forward. And in the course of investigating the claims that those folks had, it appeared that they also had claims against the Jesuits.
The new round of abuse claims against the Jesuits follows a 2007 settlement in which the Society of Jesus paid more than 100 earlier claimants $50 million in compensation. The suit filed this week names a number of priests and other clergy, some identified in past cases, including Father Henry Hargraves, who the suit says worked in Alaska for 50 years in villages and in Fairbanks. Society of Jesus administrators are also named in the suit. Cook says investigation of abuse claims has led to deeper understanding of the workings of the Jesuit organization.
We gained a lot of information about the manner in which the priests were supervised, the knowledge that the people in the provincial office had about the conduct and behavior of these priests that shows actual knowledge of their behavior and a failure to do anything about it.
The Jesuits refused to comment on the latest suit, but have issued a short written response pledging to investigate the allegations. The Society's Oregon province head, Father Patrick Lee, denies claims that the Alaska Mission was a magnet for or hiding spot for problem priests. Cook says more suits against the Jesuits are expected to be filed by additional plaintiffs. Biologists have documented an alarming decline in fur seal pups on the Pribilof Islands. The latest survey numbers show pup production is at its lowest level since 1915, down almost 5% over the last 2 years. Tom Gillette leads the Alaska Ecosystem Program for the National Marine Mammal Lab. He says the new pup numbers are dramatic.
We estimated a population, I think, of somewhere in the neighborhood of 102,000 fur seal pups on St. Paul Island, that's the largest breeding population in the world. So considering that's 2 years, you're talking about a difference in over 6,000 pups from 2 years ago. We've been seeing that now for a few years, so it's a big number, really.
And what about the population as a whole? What are the numbers?
Well, this is where it's interesting. So say about 15 years ago or so, the Pribilofs were approximately three-quarters of the world's population of northern fur seals, about 75%. Now it's about 50%. Two things are happening. One is that the population on the Pribilofs, and specifically on St. Paul, is decreasing. At the same time, that smaller populations in the throughout the world and in Russia are increasing, and so we're seeing a change in that sort of the pie chart, if you will.
And taking that into account, that the population in Alaska is declining, how are the animals doing near the Pribilof Islands? Are they healthy, the adults, or how are they?
Well, it's an interesting problem, and it's one that, or the question, and it's one that we've seen, and we've tried to answer with a number of marine mammal species. We don't find animals who are in really poor condition. We don't find animals that are starving or emaciated on the beach, similar to stellar sea lions or to other marine mammal populations that have decreased, like sea otters. You don't find the bodies. You just don't find the animals. I mean, you don't find them live, and you don't find them dead. They're just not there. So whenever we do any sort of sequence of counts and we compare it to previous counts, there's just less animals. So it's not like we're finding animals who show us some sort of indication of what's happened to their cohorts. We're just not seeing the animals.
How worried are you about this pup production decline for the Pribilof population?
It's a concern, because St. Paul continues to be the largest producer of fur seal pups in the world, so it's a significant part of the worldwide population, and we don't understand what's happening. We don't know why we're seeing the pup numbers continue to drop on St. Paul, whereas, for example, this, at least in this year's survey, at an island only a few miles away at St. George, we saw a slight increase in the number of pups. Now, that's a lot less animals. It's an order of magnitude smaller population at St. George. But nevertheless, the arrows went a different direction. It's important to remember that northern fur seals spend probably better than half of their life at sea, if not more, and more like two-thirds. And so these pups in the summer that we're looking at, they're the result of breeding that occurred the previous year in the fall, and then of their mother's survival through the winter in the North Pacific. And we don't know very much at all about what's going on there.
So what's going on, do you think? What are some possible causes for this decline?
Well, it's hard to say. I think that there's probably a combination of things that could be adding up on these animals. St. Paul is on the continental shelf. The animals have to travel farther for food than perhaps animals on St. George or, say, Bogoslav. That could be a contributor to it, especially if other factors were pushing available prey further and further off the shelf. If a female has to travel farther and longer in order to get sufficient resources, then that just reduces the amount of food available to the pup, leaves it more vulnerable, and over time, that can contribute to reduced survival of animals. That could be compounded by the availability of that prey, whether it's due to any sort of natural or human-caused event. We don't know. We do know that the primary prey of fur seals in the Pribilof has been pollock for a number of years, and that stock assessment reports show that there have been declines in the pollock abundance. So thinking about the enormous size of the area that these animals utilize and then trying to figure out what's going on over that period of time is a challenge.
Tom Gillette leads the Alaska Ecosystem Program for the National Marine Lab in Marine Mammal Lab in Seattle. He says new studies on the fur seals will try to understand what happens to the animals during the winter when they're at sea in the North Pacific. TV viewers in Alaska may lose their signal tonight for a few minutes if they're not ready for the digital television transition. Some of Alaska's TV stations will shut off their analog signal this evening for a range of 3 to 5 minutes at around 6:20. The soft test will cause viewers who aren't digitally ready to temporarily lose their TV picture. The actual transition to digital is supposed to happen in a little more than a month on February 17th. In order to receive the digital signal, viewers either need cable or satellite service, a TV with a digital tuner, or a converter box. At this point, Alaska's ARCS system of rural TV translators is not affected. The Alaska Broadcasters Association is recommending tonight's voluntary test, and many stations in Fairbanks, Juneau, and Anchorage are participating. One of those running the test is KUAC Public TV in Fairbanks. General Manager Greg Petrowich says it's a chance for viewers to see if they're ready.
We hear from people who say, oh, enough with the deadline. I've heard about the deadline. I know, February 17th, I know. And then I ask, well, have you purchased your box yet? Oh, no, I'll wait until that day. Or, oh, well, I've purchased the box, but I haven't hooked it up yet. So until the reality of your television channel is going away, you need to get that box out, hook it up, and confirm that you can get a digital signal. Otherwise, you're going to pass the deadline.
If viewers aren't ready to receive the digital signal, they'll need to get a converter box. The federal government was offering coupons for $40 discounts, but they've run out. Because of the last-minute crunch, President-elect Barack Obama's team recommended last week that conversion deadline be pushed back. Petrowich says stations have a variety of reactions to the idea of postponing. Some have heavily invested to meet the deadline, but Petrowich says a delay will likely help consumers.
And in Alaska, many issues with people who buy the box, they hook it up, they can't get a digital signal, and it may require them going up to their roof, repointing an antenna, or actually putting an antenna up, which in February, as we know here where it's been minus 40 for the last 12 days, it's not the easiest or wisest thing for people to be on their roofs installing antennas.
Alaska senators agree with the recommendation to postpone the digital switch. Senator Mark Begich says despite the hard work Alaska broadcasters have done to educate viewers, he's hearing from people confused about the transition.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The commercial and charter fishing fleets are taking their concerns over halibut catch limits to the International Pacific Halibut Commission, the IPHC. The commission has its annual meeting in Vancouver this week, and for the third year in a row, commission staff are proposing a deep cut to the Southeast Alaska harvest. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The IPHC staff is recommending a commercial limit of just under 4.5 million pounds of halibut in Southeast this year. That's a cut of about 28% from 2008. That comes on the heels of a 27% cut last year and a 20% cut the year before. The economic impact has been painful for commercial longliners, and there are mixed opinions within the fleet. Some fishermen are more critical of the methodology that led to the cuts, while some have put more trust in the IPHC scientists, supporting the commission's conservation efforts as a difficult but necessary step. One widespread concern, though, among commercial fishing organizations is a call for better management of the guided sport or charter fleet harvest. Julianne Curry is executive director of the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association, which counts many commercial longliners among its membership. Curry's organization and many others in the commercial longline sector have called for the implementation of more effective measures to hold the charter fleet to the GHL.
Important that each sector is held accountable for their catch and each sector is held to their target harvest, and the GHL is their target member. It's what we're all trying to reach, and that's the goal of North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Of course, the IPHC would love to see that number reached. Unfortunately, it just hasn't been.
This year's commercial catch recommendations assume a charter fleet GHL of 788,000 pounds in Southeast, but last year Alaska Fish and Game estimated that guided anglers on charter boats actually landed over 1.9 million pounds, more than twice as much as the charter GHL for that year. Some charter industry representatives see the overage as evidence that the GHL numbers were flawed from the beginning. Instead, they say the commission should be using the state's estimates for guided angler catches. In the case of Southeast Alaska this year, that would mean additional reductions for the commercial fleet. Earl Comstock is counsel to the Charter Halibut Task Force, a group advocating for the guided sport industry.
Well, our point really is that if you're going to use the best available estimates, which is what the commission has historically done, and frankly every other respectable fishery management agency does, then you would use those in figuring out what is the available amount of fish to be harvested by the commercial sector.
The Southeast charter fleet is also facing the possibility of a substantial cut in the amount of fish its clients are allowed to land this year. To keep the fleet within its GHL, the National Marine Fisheries Service has, for the second time, proposed a 50% reduction in guided anglers' daily bag limits in Southeast. Charter industry groups successfully defeated a NIMS proposal for a one-fish daily limit in court last season. The year before, the U.S. Commerce and State Departments rejected a similar regulation passed by the Halibut Commission, but NIMS did subsequently implement a size restriction for one of the two fish charter clients are allowed to keep. The debate between the charter fishing and commercial longline industries is one of many complex and controversial issues playing out at this week's meeting of the International Pacific Halibut Commission in Vancouver, British Columbia. The meeting continues through Friday morning when the commission's expected to announce its decision on commercial catch limits for 2009. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
A gallon isn't always a gallon when it comes to fuel deliveries. That's because Alaska bulk fuel vendors are allowed to adjust the gallon measurement to compensate for temperature-caused expansion and contraction. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the state has commissioned a study of the practice.
So-called net metering has been legal for the last 10 years. The National Council on Weights and Measures approved its use by vendors who deliver fuel by truck to customers. But not all sellers use it, and that's the problem, according to Bob Logan, a Fairbanks economist researching the issue for the state. Logan says the metering discrepancy makes it confusing for consumers trying to compare fuel vendors.
There are two different gallons of fuel being sold in Alaska retail fuel markets, such as home heating oil. And when you compare prices, if the sizes of the gallons are different, those prices are not comparable.
Logan says during Alaska's cold weather months, a net gallon averages about 2 to 3% smaller than a gross gallon. That means if two vendors are selling fuel for the same price and one uses net metering, it would cost more to have that seller fill your tank. That can add up for large fuel buyers like school districts. And Logan says most don't know what kind of gallons they're buying.
When I called, for example, the Fairbanks North Star Borough purchasing agent and asked him about this, he said he'd never heard of net gallons like pretty much everyone else, and his contracts do not specify net or gross. The same with the Gateway School District to the east of us and some of the other school districts that I've called, it's the same thing. They don't have in their contracts a specification for which kind of gallon. So they're not sure what they're getting.
Logan says most interior bulk fuel sellers use net metering. He stresses there's nothing illegal or underhanded about the practice and that the lack of a standard is the problem. Logan says the state can simplify the situation by selecting either the net or gross measurement as the official gallon.
If one or the other is eliminated, there's no need for consumers to even know what the size of a gallon is.
Logan says consumers need to ask their fuel vendor what they're paying for until the discrepancy is cleared up. Last spring, the state proposed going with the gross gallon standard, but fuel sellers objected, and the current study idea was the result. The state's director of measurement standards, Dan Breeden, says he's not leaning toward either the net or gross gallon, but a decision one way or the other. Breeden says other states are also dealing with net metering.
Nationwide, it's a fairly contentious debate, but you'll notice in warmer states, the consumers want it. In colder states, the industry wants a net compensation. Many of the colder states have already have banned it or are contemplating the same thing we are.
Breeden says a decision will be made either by the administration or through the legislature after the study is completed April 1st. If the state doesn't make its own rule, it must follow the National Council on Weights and Measures net gallon standard, which the council is currently considering expanding to cover all fuel sales, including at consumer gas pumps. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Rasmussen Foundation is announcing March 1st as the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Awards grant, which provides funding directly to artists to support their creative work. You can sign up to participate in one of the Rasmussen information sessions to be held the week of January 19th by calling 297-2876 or go online at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.